This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the third week of June, and this week the United States did not bomb Iran. There was escalation. As we discussed last week, there were those attacks on commercial ships in the Gulf of Oman, which U.S. officials say were undertaken by Iran. Then, on Monday, the Iranians shot an unmanned American drone out of the sky. Iran says the drone violated its airspace, but our government says the drone was in international territory, and so the shootdown was an unjustifiable provocation. And so the Trump administration prepared retaliatory attacks. But at the last minute, President Trump called off the operation. The New York Times reported planes were even in the air and ready to strike, although Trump told NBC's Chuck Todd the planes were still on the ground, albeit about to take off. Trump tweeted his explanation for canceling the attack Friday morning. Quote, "We were cocked and loaded and ready to retaliate last night on three different sites when I asked how many will die. 150 people, sir," was the answer from a general. 10 minutes before the strike, I stopped it. Not proportionate to shooting down an unmanned drone. I am in no hurry," unquote. We will talk about all of that in a moment. And later in today's show, Emily Bazelon of Yale Law School will join us. She recently profiled Elizabeth Warren for the New York Times Magazine. She also has a new book on prosecutorial reform, and she'll walk us through recent action at the Supreme Court. And we'll also take a look at what Joe Biden has been up to. But now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. On the left is Helene Olin of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Josh.
For our discussion on Iran, we're also joined by a special guest, Chris Doherty. Chris is a senior defense fellow at the Center for New American Security. Chris is a former senior strategist at the Pentagon, and he's an expert in defense strategy and wargaming. He joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So, Chris, one thing we were puzzling through last week was, if Iran was behind these attacks on commercial ships, what was the strategic purpose for Iran to escalate in this way? And it seems like maybe we got the answer this week, that Iran succeeded in exposing that Donald Trump was unwilling to make good on some of his belligerent threats against Iran.
I don't know if that was exactly their intention, although perhaps that's how it turned out. I think more realistically, Iran was probably simply trying to signal that it was unhappy with the status quo, and it was trying to respond to the increase in pressure that we've seen over the past month.
Rich, you wrote your column this week sort of contending that Donald Trump has a what you call a madcap caution, that he makes a lot of threats and doesn't usually make good on them, that his foreign policy is actually significantly more cautious than we've seen from some other administrations. You wrote that before this episode where he almost undertook these attacks and then didn't. Is this cautious? Because it seems to me that, you know, he escalated in a way that maybe, you know, maybe will have emboldened the Iranians going forward. Right now we're not in a war, but maybe this will blunder his way into a war sooner or later.
Well, I think it's an extreme example of madcap caution, just the idea that the planes would be underway and you'd call them back based on information that you think you would have gotten at the beginning. You know, what are the likely casualties for the other side on this is just a crazy way, obviously, to run a railroad. Last week, when we just had the most recent attacks on the tankers, I said we might have to hit Iran to establish our deterrence again. That's my natural instinct, these kind of things, but I sort of wonder now, since they're so obviously trying to goad us into at least some sort of small-scale attack, it makes me wonder whether that's the better approach or whether we should be trying something more subtle, whether it's cyber, whether it's more interdiction of shipping. But this is a conflict that is going to go on for some time.
Yeah, Chris, can you talk us through how irregular is what the president describes having happened, presumably in the Situation Room on Thursday night, where you have something like this, it's ready to go, and then you get a last-minute decision like that to go a different direction?
So I not spent a lot of time in the Situation Room myself, so that's not really my area of expertise. But what I would say is that this does sound a little irregular. I don't think that it is entirely unheard of for military operations to be called back for various reasons. But I believe, as you mentioned earlier, one would think that the pros and cons of a particular military approach would have been briefed out from the beginning before the decision was made to go altogether. And usually things are called back for things like weather or aircraft having a malfunction or something of that nature, or civilians or other unintended people on a target. Those are the kinds of things that usually call off military action, not, oh, by the way, this is going to kill 150 people. That probably should have been part of the upfront briefing. And if it wasn't, that I find that pretty surprising and pretty novel.
Yeah. Helene, what do you make of this decision? Because one thing Liz Bruning has been saying a lot on this show recently is that Trump's gut instinct that he does not want to get involved in foreign wars, she finds that to be preferable over a lot of other possible Republican presidents. You sort of wonder, you know, you had other Republican candidates who also wanted to walk away from the Iran deal. If someone like Marco Rubio was president right now, maybe we would already be attacking Iran because they would have pursued a similar strategy, but they would have gone through with the idea that you had to respond to Iran's provocation.
That's possible, but it's also possible we'd never be at this point. Part of the issue is that Trump governs as a kind of whimsical bully, for lack of a better description. He is erratic. He goes off for reasons unknown. And when he gets called on things, he often backs down at the last minute. So it's quite possible he just backed down last night after getting the conflict to this point. He then tweets out that he stopped it as if he should get credit for stopping something that he started.
Yeah. So, Chris, what are options here going forward? If the administration is seeking to put pressure on Iran, I mean, we've already put sanctions back on. Are there ways to sort of credibly push back on Iran right now without undertaking an attack like this?
Yeah, there are a variety of covert measures that the United States can take. And, you know, we're all familiar with some of them, cyber attacks being kind of the one that is probably most usually bandied about. There are a variety of methods the United States could take that aren't overt, that could be communicated to the Iranian regime. Oh, by the way, we did this, and there could be more coming your way if you don't cease these continued provocations. Those would generally have the advantage of not overtly and publicly forcing the Iranian regime to kind of do something or lose face in sort of an escalatory tit-for-tat ladder, and might allow a kind of a calming of tension even while we're still taking action. I think the other alternatives are kind of increasingly bad from there, to include things like, you know, a symmetrical strike. You know, if you attack us with a surface-to-air missile system, we will attack that system back directly. And I don't know the particulars of the strike that they had planned, but those are oftentimes the sort of thing that we do when we are attacked. But I do think that, you know, the Iranians, by attacking an unmanned system, but a fairly substantial unmanned system, really kind of put us into a bind in many ways strategically. This is not just a very simple little drone that they've shot out of the sky. It's a fairly sophisticated surveillance drone, you know, costing upward of $120 million per copy, with a lot of really sophisticated hardware on it, that is capable of seeing pretty far into Iran and tracking all sorts of interesting maritime targets. So this isn't just sort of a little minor thing that they've shot out of the sky. So it is a very interesting moment, because I think, you know, we've often thought somebody shoots a drone out of the sky, it's just no big deal. These things are disposable. That's how they've been treated throughout sort of the course of military history, in which we've seen unmanned systems at work. And that's about 60 years worth of history now. And I think this is the first time a drone of this sophistication and this level of capability has been shot down.
Do you think it's true that a symmetrical strike in response to this would have killed 150 people? Or is that plausibly just a number the president is making up?
It very, very much depends. And it depends on where the Iranians had their system located, how many personnel they were using to operate it. These sorts of things are all really, kind of contingent on all those factors. So it's very possible that, you know, if they had it located in a civilian occupied area or at a heavily occupied base, and they had, you know, put their various systems next to buildings or whatnot, that you could have seen a strike of that size taking out a substantial number of people. Whether it's 150, I think, you know, it'd be very difficult for me to speculate. But it's certainly possible that an attack, even a symmetrical one, on a SAM site and its supporting infrastructure could kill, you know, many people.
Rich, Chris talks there about some alternatives to military action here to put pressure on Iran. As the White House considers those alternatives, is there someone working on a strategy for that? Because it seems to me that you had people working on a strategy that involved this kind of military attack. You have a divided administration, some of which is more hawkish, some of which is less hawkish. And President Trump talks openly about the idea that John Bolton is trying to push him toward war, and he doesn't want to do that. So if the president has this instinct, oh, we need an alternative to military action here, do you think there's someone putting together a strategy to try to have a coherent approach to Iran that doesn't involve military strikes?
I'm sure there are people trying to come up with strategies, but this is the question of how you retaliate against what Iran is doing now. Although obviously it generates a lot of interest and a lot of headlines for obvious reasons, the bigger strategic question is, what do we do now that they obviously the answer to the question, can we make them feel significant financial pain by getting out of the deal and reimposing the nuclear deal and reimposing sanctions, is true. They're feeling that pain. But the next question is, okay, so what are you going to do with that now? So if you're going to enter into negotiations, are you sure they're going to enter negotiations, and what are the deliverables you want on an improved deal or not? I don't think we've seen a realistic account of that from the administration. If you're not counting on that happening, what's the end goal here? If it's regime change, well, that's an end goal, but it's just very unlikely to be achieved anytime soon, and something you have really limited control of.
And Helene, what is the role for Congress here? I mean, we talk about, you know, that there's no authorization for war in Iran. This is the sort of thing that you might that would be more within the traditional role of a president acting as commander in chief to react specifically to a military attack by another country, and that they shot our drone out of the sky. But what role can Congress play in trying to push the administration toward a particular policy approach here?
Well, part of the issue is we've had for several decades now Congress very infrequently coming in and acting on their traditional role of giving authorization for military action. And that's a real problem, because as a result, we end up trusting in the good faith of the president, which often is good faith, but we get Trump. Eventually, you always get a Trump or somebody like them. And then, of course, all things can go off the rails. And I think one of the things that's going on now is we have a president whose instincts are, as regular panelist Liz Brunig puts it, you know, fairly, you know, not militaristic, but at the same time is surrounded by advisors who are militaristic. And we constantly get into these positions of him coming in as a savior, sort of, and then having or alternately backing down, like with North Korea. And of course, things are going to eventually deteriorate in a way that nobody can predict.
Chris, what happens next here, which is to say we did not do a symmetrical response to this attack? Can the Iranians just shoot another one of these drones out of the sky? Are there actions that we can take to protect ourselves so this doesn't happen again? Or can we just face a series of increasing escalations to the point where the president is likely to feel pressured that he needs to have some sort of military response?
So I think there are a few things that we can do, the first of which would be to operate our aircraft in a different way, keeping them further away from Iranian territory. It's not a panacea, obviously. It's got some consequences to it. So first of all, it decreases your ability to see targets in Iran and collect information on them. On the other hand, I mean, given that this aircraft flies at, you know, anywhere between 55,000 and 65,000 feet, its ability to see fairly far into Iran is pretty substantial. And really, the targets you're surveilling in that area actually aren't that deep into Iran, because the Zagros Mountains come down fairly close to the shore. So really, you're only looking to see in a few miles at any given point, and you're surveilling the maritime terrain. So you can keep that aircraft actually fairly far away from the Iranian airspace. Now, again, like I said, given the range of Iran's surface-to-air missile threats, that's not going to keep them perfectly safe, but it will afford them a little bit more ability of room to maneuver. The other thing you could do, if you needed to, would be to escort certain aircraft with protective assets, electronic warfare assets. It's not perfect, but it would allow you perhaps to jam an incoming threat. A lot of these aircraft, especially drone aircraft, do not have their own self-defense systems. So you could escort them with something that would provide them that. The other thing you could do is you could send up cheaper, more affordable drones like, you know, MQ-1 Predators, which would allow you to test the theories of if Iran is going to keep shooting down more drones. I think that's probably a little bit more risky of a strategy. It's probably not one I would recommend. The last is to just, you know, cease these sorts of flights altogether. That I also wouldn't recommend, because you want to be keeping your eyes and ears on Iranian behavior and seeing what they're doing. Another thing they could pursue are various covert means to, one, signal intent to Iran, but two, to potentially degrade Iran's ability to conduct these sorts of strikes. And there are all sorts of things, not really comfortable talking about them in any detail in public, but there are tools available to the United States that could be used to degrade Iran's ability to conduct surface-to-air missile attacks. So it's kind of a palette of options, and there, you know, might be combinations of those, right? So operating at slightly greater range with defensive measures in place, and additionally perhaps taking some covert measures to degrade Iran's ability to conduct surface-to-air missile strikes might be sort of a nice middle ground that allows us to respond, allows us to maintain our eyes and ears on Iran, but doesn't necessarily escalate to kinetic action. I guess the last option would be sort of a very robust campaign, to kinetically suppress and degrade Iran's surface air missile systems, what we would in the defense community call their integrated air defense system. That is an enormously escalatory step. It is essentially war. You're striking targets, you know, both kinetically and non-kinetically throughout the breadth of Iran. I dearly hope that's not the end result here, because that is essentially the beginning of a conflict.
Chris Doherty is Senior Defense Fellow at the Center for New American Security. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Helene Olin of The Washington Post to talk about Elizabeth Warren with Emily Bazelon of The New York Times Magazine. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Helene Olin, columnist at The Washington Post. Elizabeth Warren is completely serious. That's the headline of Emily Bazelon's cover profile of the senator and presidential candidate in the current issue of The New York Times Magazine. A few months ago, you could have been forgiven for thinking one of the key strategic objectives for Warren's presidential campaign was to influence the policy agenda of another Democratic president. After all, she's had success with that in the past, driving the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, positioning herself to influence economic personnel choices in a potential Hillary Clinton administration, and generally pushing her party to the left on issues related to Wall Street. But as Warren has risen in the polls, driven by an electorate receptive to her fighting message and detailed plans, Bazelon has concluded that no, Warren is completely serious about becoming president and about changing the way the economy works once she gets there. And Emily Bazelon, who is staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, joins us now. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Josh.
So I was interested in your description of how and why Senator Warren's demeanor changed between when you started interviewing her for this profile in February and when you last spoke earlier this month. Like, it was clear that she was more mentally prepared for the idea that she might be president.
Yeah, that was how it seemed to me. When I started talking to her in February, she was nowhere in the polls, and she was rolling out all these policy proposals, right? And getting a reputation for being at the vanguard of the Democratic primary field in terms of having all these ideas. This whole, like, I have a plan for that was just starting to take off. And I got the sense that she was really happy to be playing that role and that that could be enough for her, even if she didn't win the primary. By the time I finished the reporting for the piece last week, she was fully in the race. And I felt like there was this more kind of sense that, like, yeah, maybe I could really be president. And that, from my point of view as a reporter, wasn't so great because it made her more guarded in talking to me. But it demonstrates the way in which she has these rising poll numbers she can point to.
Helene, what Warren is doing with having such detailed policy so early in a campaign is actually fairly unusual. Is this the right way that the campaign should be run? Because I think one of the arguments you get against this is that, you know, voters, they want to know about your broad ideological positioning, and then also what you can implement is going to be heavily driven by political circumstances once you get into office. So you can have a long list of plans, but you get in and there's not a Democratic majority in the Senate, it's not obvious where those plans go. Should campaigns be built more around this sort of very granular detail at early stages?
I think it's worked for Warren. I mean, this is Warren's brand in a way. This is what she has done her entire career. And so it has worked because it feels natural for her. What people didn't expect, including Warren, is that they felt that she would be there pushing her fellow candidates to the left. But what happened instead is that she sort of took over some of Bernie Sanders' momentum. Instead of Bernie taking over her momentum, which is what people thought would happen, it turned out Bernie was something of an Overton's window for her and made her look more reasonable. And then suddenly all her plans became more reasonable as a result.
Yeah, Rich, it has long seemed like President Trump really wants to face Elizabeth Warren as his opponent. He's, you know, very eager to talk about the Native American thing, really thinks that has damaged her as a candidate. Is she still a weak possible opponent for her? I one thing that Emily talks about in her piece is Tucker Carlson and the sort of the praise that Tucker Carlson has had for Elizabeth Warren for her populist message. Could she actually be hitting on something, her theme of economic patriotism, that could appeal to some of the working class white voters that Trump did so well with, that seems to appeal at least on some level to Tucker Carlson?
Maybe. I've never considered her a great political athlete, and I said something disparaging probably about a month ago, like having policy proposals isn't a substitute for having a brand. But as it's been pointed out, it turns out her policy proposals have become her brand, and she's had success with them. I was talking to a Republican candidate in 2016. It's like, wait, policy proposals get covered? How does this work? But she's managed to make it work, and she does seem to be eclipsing Bernie. I would just, you know, usual caution that things that seemed true 3 months ago don't seem so true, and things that we think are true right now might not necessarily hold true for the duration. I will say that to her not being a good political athlete, I just thought she was always seemed not a very powerful communicator, but maybe I'm being influenced by the rise and the narrative around it, but it just seems as though she's found a more deliberate, slow, pungent way of speaking that you associate with successful presidential candidates. And there's a little a crack of a whip at every end of her statements now that's more emphatic.
Yeah, one thing I would say, as somebody who's really been following her on and off for 20 years now, is that Warren has always had a preternatural understanding of how Americans think about finance and money and how that relates to their lives. And I think that's something that traditional political reporters kind of miss, because it's not something traditional political reporters are really thinking about that much. So Warren has a way of connecting that people, I think, took Washington by surprise. And I think, in fact, has probably taken Trump by surprise. I think Trump really felt that he had knocked her out in October after the DNA flap. But it turns out he hadn't, and that she came back. And the reason she came back is because she went back to being who she was and was her own person and stuck with the themes that had worked for her for so many years.
Emily, can you talk about the tension that you discuss in your piece about how what we've been talking about has been central to Warren's brand and has helped fuel her rise, but then you get these sort of obviously gendered, sort of vague comments about, well, she seems like too much of a professor, and that, you know, she building up this expertise has been the thing that makes her relevant as a candidate, but then maybe some people find it off-putting. How is she thinking about that? Is that a big challenge for her as she tries to build a campaign that can win not just the primary, but a general election?
I think she thinks a lot about how she communicates and is very much trying to work on it, and would probably be thrilled with what Rich was saying about the improvements he thinks that he's seeing in her. She is really good at explaining, right? Like, this has been her strength for a decade, since she went on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and in a few minutes, like, laid out this whole theory of the American economic structure and what's gone wrong that starts, like, with the founding. She's very good at that. When I was watching her on the trail, I was wondering whether that was enough, because I think for some voters, it can feel like she's trying to teach them. And then if they don't get the whole thing, that isn't necessarily the easiest way to connect with people. So that's what she's like still working on. When you look at the substance, I think Helene is right that there's this fundamental critique of how the American economy doesn't work for lots and lots of people. And Warren has this like deep understanding and theory about how that's come about. She sees FDR and the New Deal as this moment where the banks and big companies were being dismantled and regulated, and that allowed for greater economic equality for a whole era. And then she blames Reagan and Reaganism and deregulation for really dismantling the protection that supported workers in the middle class and allowed the benefits of capitalism and the market to be widely shared. So that's the sort of substance of the message, and it's why people like Tucker Carlson are interested in her. And Carlson was using her on his show to kind of shame Republicans, who, including Trump, who kind of profess to be for the white working class but aren't necessarily really translating that into economic benefits for those people.
Helene, one of the problems with this kind of message, and this is also something Emily gets into in the piece, is that there's sort of a contradiction where you basically have to describe how the government has failed, the government has been captured by the interests of the wealthy, and we're going to fix that with a bunch of new government policies. So basically, how do you get people to, at the same time, be angry about the way that politics works and has served them, and then convince them that the solution also runs through politics?
Warren's plans are remarkably consistent and simple, which is something I think people don't realize because they look complicated at first sight. But they actually are telling the same story over and over again. Our government got captured. It got captured by corporate interests. My plans are to take this apart and restore government to help you. So that, for instance, student debt forgiveness was going to help you. She released a plan that would take private industry out of the prison business. And also, by the way, private business out of the business of assisting prisoners in making phone calls and whatnot, which is an enormous profit center. And so her story about this has been consistent and simple. And I think that's something that we hear plans and we think complicated. In fact, it's a simple story. And I think voters are beginning to respond to that.
And Rich, what's the Republican response to this in the Trump era? Because you could have imagined a Romney-era Republican Party emphasizing that, you know, markets are good at allocating capital and markets lead to growth and innovation, and you impose a lot of regulation and you will stymie that. But Trump is out there sort of stipulating to the idea that the system is rigged and that there's a swamp that benefits rich elites. So what is the Republican response to say about why Warren is wrong about this when some of what Trump says would seem to suggest that she's right?
It's a little harder for the party to push back against the rigged narrative, obviously, because the President of the United States, who's a Republican, has given credence to that narrative as well. I still think although the story may be simple, I think the policies are complex and would have all sorts of unintended consequences. And Republicans, as soon as there's a Democrat in the White House that actually begins implementing this, the emphasis on freedom, the emphasis on the mistakes that come from regulation or overregulation will snap right back to where they used to be.
Emily, does Elizabeth Warren have a plan to enact all of these plans? Because we'll talk about Joe Biden in a second, but one thing that drives people on the left and the Democratic Party crazy about Joe Biden is that he goes out and basically says, well, I come from an era of bipartisanship and I've gotten Republicans to work with me in the past and I will convince them or shame them into supporting my agenda, and people think that's naive. And maybe it is naive, but what's the alternative? Warren, if she's president, she'll either have a Senate with a Republican majority or it'll have a narrow Democratic majority that relies on red state Democrats senators who aren't going to buy into her vision and all of these plans. So if she wins, what's she going to do to actually turn this stuff into policy?
Yeah, this is a dividing line between Biden and Warren. I think she has two thoughts about this. One is that she's interested in ending the filibuster. That would reduce the burden somewhat in the Senate. Another is this thing she says over and over again, which is like, everything is a fight, so let's have a big fight. And if we put out a big, ambitious vision, then her view of this, not Rich's, is that the public will get behind that. And that will push these red state Democrats, if there are really very many of them left, onto her side. There'll be a kind of groundswell. And the second answer she gives has to do with the tremendous power of the executive branch, which we're seeing the Trump administration wield, right? I mean, this is a week in which the EPA is putting out these new regulations that will allow coal plants to proliferate and continue to operate as long as the courts approve it. And what you see there is an example of the tremendous regulatory muscle of the federal government that the president can wield through executive agencies without Congress doing anything. And Elizabeth Warren would argue she's the Democrat who knows the best how to pull all those levers. She's the one who had the idea for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which the Democrats turned into reality in the wake of the financial crisis. And she kind of gets how to use all that power with or without Congress.
Can we talk a little more about Joe Biden? Helene, why don't you give us some of your thoughts on Joe Biden's week?
Okay. Democratic frontrunner Joe Biden finds himself in increasingly rocky terrain here. He still has a substantial lead in the polls, but it's a little less substantial than it was a week or two ago. The reason? Joe Biden. He's running a lackadaisical campaign on a semi-nostalgia platform. He's calling back to both the Obama years and a semi-mythical bipartisanship. He's not running an aggressive campaign. He's often avoiding press gaggles and instead attending a lot of fundraisers and sort of compensating for that by allowing a pool reporter in. And this is where this week's problems started for him. He's increasingly showing his comfort with the crowd, much in the way reality show participants sort of forget the cameras running. Biden is forgetting that there's a reporter in the room, apparently. And he's being nicer and nicer to the rich folks he's speaking to, telling them how wonderful they are. And finally, in the final scandal of the week, claimed bipartisan street cred by touting his ability to work with noted late segregationists, Senator James Eastland and Herman Talmadge. And needless to say, he got called out on that pretty quick. His response was to immediately attack the attackers and say he wasn't a racist. When you need to tell people you aren't a racist, you've lost.
So here's what I don't buy about this narrative about Biden, which is that Biden has always been like this. And 9 months ago, people in the Democratic Party really liked Joe Biden. They, you know, they found, I mean, not the Jim Eastland stuff specifically, but they found his sort of gaffe-prone tendency to be charming and a sign of authenticity. They broadly had faith in his progressive credentials as, you know, having served as Barack Obama's vice president for 8 years. And there wasn't a lot of outrage in 2008 when Obama put Biden on the ticket. And so when you go back and you sort of you look at Biden's decades of record in the U.S. Senate, and when we have now Biden talking about his time in the Senate in the 70s, this is essentially just another version of looking again at how Joe Biden behaved in the 1970s. And it just feels like if people had such a problem with Joe Biden, why is this just coming up now? And I think the answer is it's because people have other preferred candidates, or they are other candidates. And they, you know, Biden is in the way. And in order to get him out of the way, you need to make it's not just why I'm good, it's why not Joe Biden. And it sort of requires this revisiting of this decades of his record. But if the record was so bad, why weren't people complaining about it so much until just now? I don't know. Emily, what do you make of this?
I mean, I feel like the support for Joe Biden is pretty shallow. He's the most known quantity in the race. He was Obama's vice president. A lot of Democrats are starting there. And then they get reminded of the less progressive or less on the ball aspects of Joe Biden. And then they look more closely at other candidates. It is so early in this race. It feels like inevitable that the polls were going to tighten.
Yeah, I think obviously his civil rights record is pretty impeccable. And I think this is a case of reading backwards our norms and standards today to 40 or 50 years ago, where he shows up and these segregationists are really powerful members of his party and chair committees. And, you know, they're in the Senate lunchroom and it didn't occur to anyone to shun them or not speak to them. But I do think this goes to the weakness. I agree with my colleagues on the program of the Biden candidacy, or the softness when you got to kind of hide your front-running candidate, when you're afraid of him talking to the press too much, talking to the public too much, when you know he's kind of tone deaf. And I don't think the point that we need to be civil to each other and civil to people we even think are desperately wrong, historically wrong, I think that point is sound. But why, running in the Democratic primary in 2019, 2020, would you cite segregationist to make that point? It's because he said it for 30 years and he can't readjust.
Yeah, I don't know that we know yet that his position is really weakening that much. He had, you know, he had a burst in the polls when he announced his campaign. He'd been polling in sort of the high 20s before he announced, and then he popped to 40 in some polls. Now he's back at 32 in the Real Clear Politics average. So it's not clear to me that the public is pricing this stuff in yet. I don't think people know who James Eastland is. I think it's really difficult to sustain a scandal around, you know, comments about a dead political figure who had been out of the Senate for decades, who is not, you know, it's not like Trent Lott saying that Strom Thurmond should have been president. Everybody knew who Strom Thurmond was and knew what that meant.
Yeah, I think the threat would be is not this instance in particular. It's a drip drip of continual instances that create a narrative that actually is not just, you know, gaffe prone in a kind of funny, fond way, but he's not as good as this as portrayed, and not the guy you want to send up against Trump.
Emily, the other interesting thing to me about this fight is that it's not just about gaffes and statements, and it's not just about statements on sort of, you know, broad societal non-policy questions like, you know, how should we talk about somebody like James Eastland. One thing you get into a lot in your profile of Elizabeth Warren is the very long-standing disagreement between her and Joe Biden over bankruptcy laws. This is the bill that passed in 2005 that made it significantly more difficult to file for personal bankruptcy. So there is, you know, there is a substantive policy dimension here. But it just comes back to me, you know, if we're so upset about the bankruptcy bill, why wasn't that disqualifying for Joe Biden before?
Right. I mean, I think what you see here is a divide over how friendly to be toward Wall Street. And since Bill Clinton's presidency, the people in charge of the Treasury Department, economic policy for Democratic presidents have been Wall Street friendly, amenable, and Biden is very much in that group. Elizabeth Warren and, you know, to her left, Bernie Sanders, very suspicious of the influence of money and the idea that you can really reform the financial system unless you take on those interests. And so that is a real divide here. And I think we're going to hear about it a lot. Now, the bankruptcy bill is an old fight, right? We're talking about 95 to 2005. But it's emblematic of this ongoing question about who gets to control economic policy when a Democrat is in office.
Helena, I think a thing that's underlying a lot of this Joe Biden fight that most people don't want to say out loud, there are a few who do, like Matt Stoller is a lefty economic commentator who basically says that Obama was a bad and failed president. And it goes back, for example, to this Wall Street stuff. You had the financial crisis and you had an emphasis on shoring up the financial institutions, bailing out banks, trying not to be too tough on the banks in a way because the banks were financially weak and it was felt that it was important to ensure that they remained as going concerns. That was more important than accountability. And so basically, you know, you have a critique now that this was a mistake and that this, you know, this failed to protect certain homeowners, that it was too nice to certain people who were bad actors who had done things that caused the crisis, maybe will lead them to do things that cause a subsequent crisis. But it feels like if we're going to have that argument out loud, it's not just about Joe Biden. You have to be able to say that Barack Obama screwed up there, both in his appointments and in his policy choices. And people don't want to say that in a party where people have really positive feelings about Barack Obama.
I absolutely agree. I remember when I was watching Biden's campaign announcement, he was playing all this 60s and 70s and 80s music. And one of the songs I thought he should have played and didn't was Barbara Streisand's theme from The Way We Were, about the past and how we choose not to remember what's so painful for us. We simply choose to forget it. And I think the problem with Biden running is that it's forcing people to remember it in a way that is not helpful, really, to the Democratic Party, because most people do have a great feeling about Obama. But in actual fact, as you pointed out, the banks get bailed out. The homeowners really did not. There were millions upon millions of foreclosures. Net wealth for African Americans was lower at the end of Obama's term than when it began, mostly because of the foreclosure crisis. African Americans have most of their wealth tied up in housing. And as a result, this run, as it's bringing up all of these tensions with war, especially with Warren, is in terms of the Wall Street friendliness, the friendliness to the banks, the friendliness to the financial sector, the friendliness to the wealthy donors, is bringing all of this up to the surface.
Still with me are on the left, Helene Olin of The Washington Post. On the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And Emily Bazelon of The New York Times Magazine is also with us. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what's your Tweet of the Week?
So my tweet is someone who tweets as so-called at Allapundit. And he was commenting on a Richmond Times-Dispatch story about Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax in Virginia thinking about running for governor in 2021. And Allapundit tweeted, "Very on brand for 2019 that a politician accused of multiple sexual assaults views it mainly through the prism of name recognition."
Helene Olin, what tweet struck you?
Oh, I loved Republican pollster Frank Luntz's tweet from Vienna, where he was in a shoddy hotel, and he tweeted out, "I'm at the Hotel Imperial in Vienna, Austria, almost 200 rooms, but the elevator has been broken for 3 days. Please don't bring European-style socialism to America." First, the hotel was privately owned. Second, really, this shows just how crazed the socialism boogeyman is making certain Republicans. Anybody who's ever gone on Yelp and read hotel reviews, which I actually had to do this week, knows that American hotels are filled with broken elevators, bed bugs, and the one I saw this week that was particularly disturbing, a bathroom featuring a, quote, mysterious red stain. This is driving people crazy, the socialist boogie person, and it needs to stop.
The Hotel Imperial, not just privately owned, it's a Marriott property. Emily Bazelon, what's your Tweet of the Week?
So Jonathan Zittrain tweeted about this awesome new project for law nerds called the Case Law Access Project, in which, so Zittrain says, for the first time in history, you can do n-grams across all American and colonial case law. Pick a word or phrase and see how often it's been used in the law over time. And this is all thanks to scanning 44 million pages of 44,000 volumes. So, like, for example, this is a tweet thread, so it's a little longer. You can see that disputes about nudity started to spike in the 1960s, or that people started in the court, started writing about the Federalist Papers again after a 100-year sleep in the middle of the 20th century.
My tweet of the week comes from Arin Carmone, my colleague at New York Magazine and a frequent guest on this show. She's in Aspen for the Ideas Festival, and she tweets an exchange she overheard. A bartender asks, "Are you here for Aspen Ideas?" And his customer replies, "No, I have no ideas." I've been talking with Helene Olin of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review and Emily Bazelon of The New York Times Magazine. We will be back to talk about Charged, which is Emily's new book on prosecutorial reform. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Helene Olin, columnist at The Washington Post. And Emily Bazelon of The New York Times Magazine is our special guest. If you listen to Left, Right, and Center's sister show, All the President's Lawyers, and you should be listening to it, you know I host with Ken White, who's a criminal defense attorney. And one theme on that show is the huge power prosecutors hold over how criminal defendants get punished. The prosecutors decide what crimes to charge, and that decision can put a judge in a position where he or she has little or no choice about how to sentence a defendant. So if we want to make changes about who we incarcerate and for how long, we either need to change the degree of discretion prosecutors have, or we need to elect prosecutors who will exercise discretion differently. This is the subject of Emily Bazelon's new book, Charged, which looks at reform efforts in prosecutorial offices around the country. Emily, can we start by talking about illegal gun possession? Because it's a tension you raise right at the start of the book. Liberals are eager for more restrictive and better enforced gun laws. But on the ground, gun enforcement often means long prison terms for young black men who often haven't even fired the guns they're arrested for possessing.
Yeah, I was focusing on mandatory minimum prison sentences for people who have guns without a permit in New York. It turns out that this kind of is the flip side of liberal gun control, this really punitive approach to people who have firearms without a license, usually in big cities. And what I found in following people who are facing these charges was that they were being called the most dangerous evildoers in the city by Mayor Bill de Blasio. But in fact, these were not the shooters. There was no evidence that they had actually hurt anyone with their guns. And when I asked a lot of them, this is mostly young men, mostly poor people, lots of young black men. When you ask them why they have guns, they say they have them for protection. There is a kind of defense quality to why they're carrying the guns. It may be totally misguided. I mean, I talked to people who are carrying guns who had gotten shot while they were carrying. So it wasn't that this was an effective strategy for staying safe. And in fact, it made the streets more dangerous. But watching this play out in court day after day in Brooklyn, I felt like I was watching another incarnation of the war on drugs, where you have this deep social problem that has to do with poverty and other aspects of just like social dysfunction. And there is a small group of like scary people who are shooting people. But then the city and state's reaction to this is to scoop up many hundreds of other people and then funnel them all off to prison. It started feeling like a kind of zero tolerance, blanket, one size fits all punitive approach to a much more complicated problem.
What do you say to people who say, "I don't want guns in my neighborhood, especially guns possessed by people without permits or with criminal records," and that we need prison sentences to get dangerous people off the street and perhaps as importantly, to deter illegal gun ownership? So if somebody's out, say, dealing drugs, at least he's not carrying a gun around. Because as you note, you know, this is a very risky strategy for self-defense. And, you know, in an individual case, a person may not have fired their gun. But if more of these people are out there with guns, they may, in a mistaken belief that it is a good way to protect themselves, end up committing an act of violence. Isn't the justification for this enforcement basically to get guns and people with guns off the street before they shoot someone?
Yeah, sure. And then you want to look at the evidence that supports that justification, because it's what the cops and what the New York City mayor were saying. And it turns out that researchers have studied this all over the country and that there's just no evidence that mandatory minimum sentences for gun possession reduce violence, right? And if that sounds counterintuitive, well, think about what we know generally about zero tolerance approaches. Like, they sound reassuring, but then when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, you're treating a big group of people in the same way, and you end up sending lots of people to prison when they are all going to come out on the other end, right? These are not life sentences. And then you've made them even less equipped to be productive citizens and really contribute to their neighborhoods. And so there are alternative approaches for making the streets safer in poor urban neighborhoods. There is some really good sociology about improving what's called social cohesion, how much people look out for each other in the neighborhood. And, you know, even findings about increasing the number of nonprofits in a community that do a whole range of work, not just like direct violence prevention, that can have a good effect on reducing the homicide rate.
Rich, what do you make of that? I mean, a talking point you hear a lot from Republicans is saying we don't need new gun laws. We need to enforce the existing laws we have. Here, Emily's saying that actually overzealous enforcement of those laws may be counterproductive.
I do think, and Emily knows much about this area than I do, that straw purchases are generally something that are ignored by prosecutors and, you know, feed the illegal gun trade. I take Emily's point, if I can maybe extend it out some, I think zero tolerance should be a phrase that's just sort of excised from our vocabulary, because it inevitably leads to arbitrary decisions and overreach and irrational things, because you're substituting a very standard rule for accounting for circumstances and motives and things that happen in real life. And I would have been much more dismissive of what I take to be Emily's general argument in this book, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. I'm not so much anymore. And I just look at the Julian Assange indictment, the latest one, and a listener's program know I have zero use for Julian Assange, but it just seems so arbitrary. So is it one count with exposure of 5 years, or is it 17 counts with an exposure of 150 years? And the prosecutor just gets to decide that? That seems like a really huge question, and just that's a massive amount of prosecutorial discretion. I'm not sure what the alternative is, but it's a concern.
Yeah, Emily, could you talk about that broadly, sort of that, you know, people think of judges as handing down sentences, but really it's sort of prosecutors who make the charging decision that are heavily controlling how much time people spend in prison.
Yeah. So what happened in the 80s in this country was that we increased sentences. It was a time when crime was rising and people were scared for understandable reasons. What we did the most was to have lots of these mandatory minimum sentences. I agree with Rich about the problem with zero tolerance, but that was the tactic we took. The idea was to eliminate discretion from the criminal justice system, but that's just not possible. And so what ended up happening, even though we didn't talk about it this way, was that we took discretion away from judges at sentencing and we gave it to prosecutors, because they're the ones who make the kinds of decisions about charging that Rich was just outlining. And they also are the ones who make plea bargaining offers. There are no limits on how much prosecutors can charge or how high they can go in terms of the kind of sentence they're threatening if someone refuses to plead guilty. And so in this limitless system, what you see are prosecutors using their power to hike up charges and threaten big sentences if you go to trial. They use that power to coerce, I would argue, or certainly encourage many, many people to plea bargain. And so you see the trial virtually disappear from our system. In a lot of state courts right now, something like 95% or more of convictions are obtained through plea bargains. And that's the kind of grand sweeping changes that are behind the dynamic in the Julian Assange case.
Helene, this is something that's come up a fair amount in the presidential campaign, especially surrounding Kamala Harris, who was the district attorney in San Francisco and was attorney general of California, and some policies she used that basically used this prosecutorial threat explicitly to try to coerce people into certain behavior. And she's, you know, she said that there are some things she did that she regrets, but she's also made a case that this stuff can be progressive, that, you know, she was trying to get parents to make sure that their children go to school and certain things like that. She's made a case of prosecution as an avenue for progressiveness. Do you think that case washes at this point?
I think what the Harris issue shows, and I actually think it points to why she's not picked up as much traction as everybody thought she would, is that Harris is a bit more of a follower than a leader. When we move towards, you know, being more vindictive on crime, on being more punishing of crime, she was, you know, really with that. And she... And she followed along. And for instance, the truancy thing, you know, it ended up where mothers of in very troubled families were being prosecuted. I mean, this is really not a good thing. On the other hand, you know, she didn't really come out for marijuana legalization until 2018, which is, you know, kind of late in the game if you are really going to crack down on this sort of stuff.
Do you agree with that assessment, Emily?
I think Harris did some things as DA in San Francisco years ago that at the time were like in the vanguard. She had a diversion program for first-time drug offenders, for example, that now doesn't seem at all exciting or radical, but at the time, not very many cities were even doing that. The problem is that the progressive prosecutor movement has moved so far beyond where she was then that for her to defend her whole record and to claim to be a progressive prosecutor, you know, people within that movement who have worked very hard to elect district attorneys who are doing far more than Harris did then, they don't want that label watered down, and they're pushing back. And they're looking at things like those truancy prosecutions Helene was talking about with, like, deep skepticism. So that's the kind of challenge for Harris in trying to straddle this divide.
Finally, on today's show, why don't we talk a little bit about the Supreme Court? Justice Kavanaugh has been on the court for several months now. Justice Gorsuch has been there about 2 years, and they've ended up on the opposite sides of a number of significant cases. Emily, are they performing differently than you would have expected them to at the time that they were confirmed?
I mean, not really. I just don't see anything all that significant that is putting daylight between them. And in the biggest cases that we're looking at this term, I expect them to vote the same way, and we don't have those decisions yet. I'm talking about whether the Trump administration can add a question about citizenship to the next census, and then whether courts have any ability at all to address partisan gerrymandering. We're probably going to get those decisions next week. I expect Gorsuch and Kavanaugh to be on the side of the Trump administration in the census case and against letting courts intervene to stop political gerrymandering, no matter how extreme it is.
Rich, what have you made of them? I mean, we've seen some cases, for example, where Gorsuch has aligned with the liberals on some issues related to criminal defendants. Justice Kavanaugh sided with the liberals on an antitrust case, basically saying that Apple can be sued by consumers who are maybe harmed by anti-competitive practices in the App Store. Are they less down the line conservatives than you expected?
I think it's too early to make big pronouncements about what kind of justice they're going to be. I think Gorsuch clearly has an idiosyncratic streak. I think some of the splits between the two of them have been interesting, but would seem to me just to be a function of, you know, they're not robots. They are very serious jurists with various deeply held views of the law, and they don't entirely line up like they're on the same partisan team, which they shouldn't.
Helene, what decisions have you been watching this term that you think have significant implications?
Well, I mean, the Gundy decision this week, where Gorsuch was in the minority, is actually one I've been keeping an eye on, and one that, by the way, Kavanaugh did not take part in because he was not on the court yet when the case was heard. But it has disturbing implications for the future of regulation in the United States.
I think we should say that this is a case about sex offender registration, but the key constitutional issues here are not really about sex offenses or crime. It's basically about the extent to which the legislature can delegate power to an executive agency to make regulations.
Right. And there was a small portion in Gorsuch's ruling that was of incredible concern to anybody who believes in the regulatory state, which is that essentially, and this is actually very hard to put in very simple terms.
Emily, can you walk through this? It would essentially undermine the ability to have laws that rely on agencies to put out really complex regulations in order to enforce them.
Yeah, I mean, right, exactly. Since really the 1930s, when federal agencies got more powerful and regulations got more complex, Congress has often deferred to the agencies to write all the fine print. It's a delegation, it's called, of power from Congress to the executive branch. And this Gorsuch dissent that you're talking about calls into question this whole way of doing business. It looked like there were 4 votes, and then we just haven't heard yet from Kavanaugh for this theory. Hard to tell tell in the end how seismic a shift it would be, because Gorsuch makes it sound like really huge. Because if Congress has to pre-write all the regulations, that is a big shift of responsibility from the agencies onto Congress. But then there's some language from Gorsuch about how, oh, don't worry, the agencies can still fill in all the details. I think if you're worried about this decision, the reason to worry about it is that if Congress truly had to pre-write lots of fine print, it would be lobbyists, corporate lobbyists, who were doing a lot of that work, and that is a real change in how we write regulations in this country.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
AOC called U.S. immigration detention facilities at the border concentration camps and then tried to defend this obviously inapt, to put it mildly, term for facilities that are desperately overtaxed by an ongoing crisis and are used only to temporarily house immigrants before, by and large, releasing them into the country.
Helene Olin, what's your rant?
This week marked a dismal record, the longest period with no increase in the national minimum wage since Franklin Roosevelt first signed such legislation during the New Deal. It remains firmly where it was since July of 2009, where it's since lost 15% of its value. The Trump administration is against any minimum wage at all. This is meanness for the sake of meanness. Even McDonald's and Walmart say it should go up.
Emily Bazelon, what's on your mind?
There was another Supreme Court decision this week involving the takings clause. In other words, what the government has to do to take your property. And the five conservative justices on the court overturned a precedent that really dates back to the 1800s. The liberals on the court, particularly Justice Elena Kagan, raised an alarm. And the reason for this is not this particular case. It's really Roe versus Wade, which is seen as this very steady bedrock precedent for providing access to abortion. But the more the conservatives on the court seem ready to jettison approaches the Supreme Court has taken in the past, no matter how long standing, the more it seems likely that they could take a similar axe to Roe versus Wade.
For my rant, Neel Kashkari was the Republican nominee for governor of California in 2014, and now he's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And he says the Fed should have cut interest rates by half a point when it met this week. On this, he agrees with President Trump. Trump doesn't have a very good argument for rate cuts, but Kashkari does. He notes the Fed has consistently missed its inflation target of 2%, and while growth remains positive, it's slowing down. A commitment by the Fed to cut rates and keep them down until inflation actually hits its target would boost growth by making it cheaper for businesses to invest and for families to buy homes. And hitting the inflation target would give the Fed more room to support the economy in the next recession by cutting real interest rates below zero. Trump has tried to put some jokes and cronies on the Fed board. If he wants a serious argument for the monetary policy he apparently wants, he should give Kashkari a permanent seat on the board. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Helene Olin, and Emily Bazelon. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.